from inside as he snapped all the latches and chains and bolts in place. They could hear him laughing, a sound that went on for quite some time, even after he'd shut off all the lights and left them there in the dark. Chapter 41. They were back in the center city at about 12:30 a.m. and went up to McManus's conference room to talk over where they were. Senate was unexpectedly paged. It turned out to be the city desk at the Tribune. They had the story. Government mole in the courthouse. Tui had figured a way to spread the word to his cohorts without risk. Stan had about 10 minutes before the 1 a.m. deadline on the late edition to decide how to respond. He settled on no comment, hoping the paper didn't have enough confirmed information to run the story. If so, the Petros investigators would get one last day to operate with the advantage of surprise. At 1:10, the reporter, Stu Dubinsky, called back. They were going with their story. Stan had known Dubinsky for years and concluded this wasn't a ploy. After talking it over with McManus, Stan went on background with Stu. Senate's goal was to make it sound as if Petros was already a staggering success. Thousands of hours of tape, he said, dozens of undercover encounters with an enormous array of courthouse personnel. No comment on how high it went, but judges, plural, were sure to be indicted. The group, Stan, McManus, Evan, Robbie, Tex, and Amari, sat around the conference table, sculling things out until nearly 2. There would be calls tomorrow from defense lawyers feeling around. If somebody out there was frightened enough, he might make an anonymous proffer, hoping for immunity. Things could break from any direction. By now, it made no sense to go home. Robbie called again to check on Rainey, then went up to his office to sleep a few hours on his sofa, something he had often done during trials. For almost everybody on the team, it was the second straight night with little or no sleep. But Evan was still running on adrenaline. Twice within 24 hours, she'd had a gun in her hand, ready to fire. He didn't come down from that fast. She volunteered to go upstairs with Robbie to stand guard. She was ready to talk, but he waved to her from the couch, and with that fell backward, appearing to succumb to sleep in descent. At 4:15, she made coffee in the office kitchen and brought a cup back for each of them. It seemed unimaginable that she'd lived 6 months without caffeine while she'd been playing Mormon. Robbie was awake, just setting down the phone when she opened his door. "Rainey?" she asked. "Mort. I wanted to talk to him before he read the papers." He hadn't put on his shoes yet and took an instant to study his toes. She asked how Morty had taken it. "Shock? Disbelief? I told him to hire a lawyer, you know, 'cause he can have some trouble with his license, but he seemed more worried about me." He was by himself momentarily, smiling contentedly at the thought of Mort. "He knows he'll be okay anyway if the story is coming from me." He looked up at Evan after he'd said that, but she was too tired to probe. Everyone assembled again at 4:45. Driven by Amari, the surveillance van swept into the garage beneath the Lesueur, and Senate, Evan, McManus, and Robbie jumped in. They'd just parked across the street from St. Mary's when Tui and Kosick arrived at the foot of the 3 tiers of cathedral stairs. Rollo looked down the street, a cigarette hanging from his lips, while Tui headed upward deliberately, his pace and posture suggesting he would pray with special determination today. Several vehicles from Joe's surveillance crew circled on the avenues. Summer had not yet arrived, and even spring was frittering. It had been less than 40 overnight, and the smoke of the furnaces kicking in wisped away above the roofs, carried off against the livid hues of first light. The large red brick church was narrowly imposed on a triangular piece of land. The adjoining streets, largely untrafficked, angled off beside St. Mary's, the big buildings set back from the pavement, and all but vacant at this hour. An arid beauty arose from the quiet avenues in these last few moments of repose. This was the city, thousands of souls nearby, in slumber. The race, the journey, would begin again soon. Rollo walked alone. He was cold. He jammed his hands in the pockets of his windbreaker, striding briskly toward Paddywax, where Milaki would meet him as Plato opened the doors. As soon as Kosick was clear of the church, McManus gave the signal, and the first car pulled up abruptly at the curb beside him. The agents surrounded Rollo, pointing back to the van. The idea was to get him inside, where they'd planned an elaborate show-and-tell. But Kosick just threw his hand at them and resumed walking. The van followed him along the curb, but he refused to look over. Finally, Sennett disembarked. Stan had to hustle to catch up with him. Even watched through the bubbled window, Kosick wouldn't stop as Sennett spoke to him. Finally, McManus alighted and trotted up to the pair. He touched Rollo's sleeve, and although Kosick shirked him off violently, he halted when McManus spoke. He seemed to recognize Jim somehow, and finally appeared taken aback. Apparently, they hadn't yet realized the intricacy of the government's deceptions. McManus had left the van with the torn note Rollo had written at Attitude, and with some of the bills on which his prints had turned up. They were all stored in clear plastic envelopes, edged in tape that said Evidence in red. Jim was careful not to let Kosick touch any of this. Instead, he stood a few feet away and displayed each item, holding it by its upper corners, looking like a street-side vendor outside a shrine. Sennett was talking all the time. Even could not read his lips, but she knew the pitch anyway. Rollo was dead. Deader than dead. There were stiffs in the graveyard who were lively by comparison. They had taps on his phone, surveillance. Rollo had just a few minutes to make a decision that would control the rest of his life. Finally, as the coup de grace, Sennett motioned to the van, and both Robbie and Even stepped out to the curb. Favor this time seemed robust. He winked at Rollo and threw up one palm in greeting. Kosick's eyes, as always, were daggers of malice. He said one thing to Sennett. "Suck my dick," he told the U.S. attorney, and resumed walking, bucking his arms like chicken wings to warm himself. Sennett called threats down the street. He was going to convict Kosick, then immunize him. He'd jail him for perjury or contempt if he lied or remained mute. Kosick would do time, then more time. Rollo had two choices, a lifetime in the can or putting it on Tui. His number was up. 30 feet on, Kosick finally wheeled. But he directed nothing to Sennett. It was Robbie on whom he focused, his dry face wrenched by anger. Kosick pointed the black nail, then threw out his hand at groin level, twisting his wrist violently in the air. It was not clear if this was a wish about what he'd done the last time he saw Robbie at Attitude, or a threat for the future, but it was certain he did not mean well. My phone rang at 6:30 that morning. I picked it up in the kitchen, rushing to grab it before it wakened Patrice, who'd just returned again from Bangkok. It was Sennett. I'd already seen the headline on the Tribune on my doorstep, "Government Mole Nabs Judges." Stan received my congratulations with little enthusiasm. The atmosphere of manic secrecy had finally lapsed. There were no code words or subverted tones. Stan sat in the United States Attorney's office after an exhausting evening and gave me the lowdown on what had transpired last night in a weary but forthcoming fashion. Despite Sennett's failures with the biggest targets, the prosecutors still had some success. Judith had pancaked, flattened, and flipped when Moses Appleby explained that the government would be able to forfeit her restaurant once she was convicted of racketeering. Milaki had sent Moses away, but without acrimony. Sig appeared to be considering his options. Another team, led by Assistant U.S. Attorney Sonia Klonsky and Shirley Nagel, had also had mixed results. Walter Wunsch had shown no inclination to meet his maker with a clean conscience. He'd listened to Robbie's recording in his living room. His wife, in her curlers, had more or less bullied her way in, and, once she had the picture, berated Walter about his brains and character, a barrage Walter'd absorbed like a stone. When Klonsky's pitch was over, Walter referred to Malatesta as a cluck and stated that he never gave Silvio shit. Aside from that, he'd refused comment, except to note that he now had two reasons to be glad he'd be dead soon. He did not elaborate on either, but he was glowering at his missus when they left. After that, things for Klonsky and Shirley's team had improved. Two clerks, Joey Kwan and Pinkus Leibovic, had turned, without any promises, and had been debriefed through much of the night. Both had named several lawyers for whom they had carried money. Kwan gave up three judges who were now sitting in the felony division. Both Pinkus and Joey were on the phone in the federal building at this very moment, the tape recorder reels turning behind them as they called every lawyer and judge they'd implicated, telling them about Robbie, and trying, supposedly, to cook up stories that would explain various odd-looking financial transactions when the Bureau knocked on the door. Rousted from bed at 3 or 4 in the morning, many of the subjects had been too frightened to be guarded, and the results were notable already. Petros, like an ink spill, was already spreading darkly. For the moment, Sennett was wondering whether to let TV cameras into McManus's law office. He'd have to clear it with UCORC, but the elaborate cover, the equipment, the expense and care of the government's efforts would be intimidating to the bad guys and might shake a few of them loose. The news that the FBI had been operating a law office right out of the Le Sueur building was bound to break soon anyway. Stan seemed to be seeking an opinion from me, but I expressed none. Now that the veil had been lifted, we'd all have to resume our standard roles. In relating all of this, Stan's tone had been somewhat listless. I assumed he was exhausted, or perhaps taking it easy on me, guessing correctly that I felt a considerable pang that I hadn't been there to witness the concluding scenes in the drama. But it turned out that despite the government's advances, the same bone was still stuck in his throat. "I can't believe we won't get Tui. I can't believe it." He had a solid case on Kosick, but nothing beyond that. No matter how obvious it was as a matter of common sense that Rollo could not have been freelancing, there was no evidence, circumstantial or direct, that tied Tui to either the money Rollo accepted or the directives that Kosick occasionally issued. As Robbie had always insisted, Tui had seen far ahead and planned accordingly. Kosick stood between Brendan and trouble like a castle moat. Stan had sent Robbie home to sleep with several agents to guard him, but there was a problem with favor that had prompted Stan's call. Robbie insisted on paying a personal visit to Magda Medzik in order to explain face to face. He knew he'd never get through the buzzer at her apartment, so he intended to make a trip today to the courthouse. Stan was worried about the reactions Favor's presence there might excite. My assignment was to convince my client not to go. When I arrived at Robbie's house, there were two agents in the driveway. I had a little trouble with them until Klecker appeared and walked me inside. Even was taking a sleeping shift in an empty bedroom upstairs. Robbie was also out cold, and I decided I'd let him sleep a while longer. I'd brought a stack of the newspapers for all of them, and Alf and I talked it over. He'd gotten his own reports on the flip teams, and he was, as usual, jolly. Joey Kwan, in his haphazard way, had already made two great tapes on felony court judges. He'd played Dumbbell, the language-hampered Chinaman who needed everything repeated and explained several times. The perps had barfed all over themselves. Robbie wandered down. He'd gotten up to check on Rainey, who was unchanged. I'd heard the quiet whoosh of the inhalation equipment without realizing what it was. Shallowly, Desperately she breathed, drowning, as it were, in her own bed. "Finally a star," Robbie said when he caught sight of the papers. "Christ, where'd they get that picture? It's worse than my driver's license." It was an archive photo of Robbie coming out of the courthouse, an off-angle, hurried shot, taken as he was emerging in the thrall of a big win. He sported a vulpine smile, which would send exactly the message Stan desired. Eventually, Robbie and I drifted back to the family room, a huge space which descended a few steps off the kitchen. Like the rest of the house, it had been glamorously decorated in an overstated contemporary fashion, with raw silk wall coverings and bowl-shaped furniture. Because it fell to another level, the room had been virtually abandoned during the course of Rainey's disease. The giant projection TV formerly housed here had been moved to their bedroom, while the various machines that had aided Rainey in earlier stages of her illness were now warehoused in rows. The motorized wheelchair, lifts, trapezes, an elevated bed she had given up. It was like sitting in a hospital supply room. Robbie literally gave Stan's request the back of his hand. "I'm not really asking, George. I'm telling. They can help me or not. I gotta see Magda. They can bring me there in the Popemobile, but I'm going." I made a desultory effort to change his mind, then let it go. He told me I should be braced for a call from Mort's lawyer, whoever it might turn out to be. It was approaching 9 as I drove back into town. I already had 8 messages from attorneys and 1 from Barnett Skolnick. I asked my secretary to contact each caller and explain that if they'd phoned concerning the FBI's investigation at the courthouse, and as it turned out they all had, a conflict would prevent me from holding any conversation. The local news stations, when I flipped on the radio, were all Petros all the time. I told myself not to gloat, it was none of my business. But my hair stood on end when I heard an anonymous lawyer who'd been pulled aside on the street remark that practicing law in Kendall County would be better from this day forward. Nonetheless, a good 80% of what was reported was wrong, some of it almost comically in error. Every station, for example, claimed authoritatively that Robert Fever was actually an FBI agent. As a result, I wasn't sure how to take the flash item that ran around 9:30 as I was approaching Center City. Despite the heavy traffic, I pulled over in a no-parking zone to be certain I didn't run anyone down as I punched between stations. The same story was repeated everywhere. Within the last hour, a high-ranking court official in the Common Law Claims Division named Rollo Kosick had entered the men's sauna at a downtown health club and shot himself through the head with a police-issue revolver. There was speculation, presently unconfirmed, that Kosick's death was related to the widespread FBI investigation of courthouse corruption, codenamed Project Petros. Chapter 42. Around 2 that same day, a delegation comprised of Even, Amari, Klecker, and Robbie arrived at the temple in the surveillance van. Judge Winchell had signed an order authorizing the FBI to seize Barnett Skolnick's Lincoln and to remove the taping system from it. Skolnick had hired Raymond Horgan, Senate's old boss in the prosecuting attorney's office, to represent him, and Raymond had turned contentious when he was served with the seizure notice. He'd forced a brief hearing in front of Judge Winchell at noontime, but he'd ultimately surrendered the key rather than require the car to be towed. While Raymond was almost certainly posturing for purposes of negotiation, Moses Appleby had directed Klecker to make an elaborate video for the benefit of a future jury, not only depicting the removal of the equipment, but also demonstrating how the taping of Skolnick had taken place. When that was done, Senate and McManus had agreed that Robbie, with an FBI escort, could pay a short visit to the chambers of Magda Medzik. In the wake of the news about Kosick, Everyone seemed off kilter. Even herself did not know what to make of it. They'd spent so many months telling themselves there were mortal dangers to what they were doing that a fatality could hardly be called unexpected. But she'd never envisioned it might be one of the bad guys. No one was collecting for a wreath, but even Sennett had wondered out loud if he'd overdone it this morning. Rollo apparently believed him when Stan told him he had no way out. Rollo'd had his revenge anyway, since he'd taken with him the last hope of prosecuting Tui. Brendan's defense was now patent. Blame Rollo, say he was the mastermind. Clothed with the authority of the presiding judge, Kosick had collected money, made assignments, given orders, all without Brendan's knowledge, much as the government's own evidence would show had occurred with Walter and Malatesta. The bastard had misled poor trusting Tui and then taken his life rather than confront the boss and friend he'd betrayed. That would sell with the public, even some segments of the bar. Kosick had saved Tui not only from indictment, but also from ridicule. In the temple garage, an agent operated a standard video cam as Klecker showed how he'd punctured Skolnick's tires. Then the Lincoln was repositioned out in front of the courthouse. For the camera, Robbie briefly stood on the spot where he'd met Skolnick. Then he entered the Lincoln and turned the key to power the system. Standing outside the surveillance van, Klecker used the remote to turn the camera on and off a couple of times. Then the van was driven down the block to demonstrate the range of transmission. Once everything had been acted out for the jury, favor killed the ignition. With the Lincoln parked right in front of the courthouse, they decided it was best to take Robbie in from here now and to remove the equipment later. Amari remained behind in the surveillance van down the block to watch over everything. Klecker had brought a bulletproof vest for Robbie, but Robbie refused it and turned petulant when Even attempted to persuade him to put it on.
"A lot of people in there want to kick my ass, but nobody's going to shoot me in broad daylight."
He hiked off alone, forcing Klecker and Even to catch up. Robbie was in and out of Judge Medzik's chambers in 10 minutes. He said he'd spent most of the time waiting for her to get off the bench. Magda had made her law clerk stand in the room as a witness, which had proved a mistake because she had been unable to keep herself from crying near the end.
"She's pretty Catholic," said Robbie to Even on the way out. "She turned herself in to the Supreme Court Judicial Disciplinary Committee."
He had suggested nails through the palms might have saved her time, which was when she'd asked him to leave. They emerged from the courthouse with Klecker a few steps ahead. Even was supposed to cover Robbie from the rear, but he was still smarting from the visit. What he felt worst about, he said, was that Magda had seemed resigned to the world of locked closets and prim restraints, where she'd been cloistered when they'd first taken up.
"She's at less than zero now," was how he put it.
Whatever he'd given her had been jettisoned as she'd yielded again to the in terrorem lectures she'd practiced on herself over a lifetime. Even heard him out, unexpectedly pricked by sympathy for both Robbie and the judge. Then she let him take off a few steps ahead of her as she surveyed the broad plaza around the courthouse for signs of danger. There was nothing notable, attorneys with briefcases, messengers, clerks, citizens all moving briskly. The spring chill had persisted, and the wind, a winter remnant, snapped the flags overhead, ringing the halyard of one of them against the steel pole. A few passers-by cast looks at Robbie, who had suddenly grown recognizable thanks to the morning press, but they made no movement toward him. Reaching the center of the plaza, he skirted the large modern fountain where the water was now running again, cascading over the stepped plains of travertine. Circling the perimeter, Robbie stopped in his tracks, even dashed two or three steps until she saw the problem. Brendan Tui was no more than 10 feet away, hurrying back to the courthouse with a heavy briefcase. The weight of the satchel and the fact that he was uncharacteristically alone
left even with an intuition that he'd been cleaning out safe deposit boxes he'd shared with Kosick. Whatever the accuracy of that conjecture, the presiding judge, a man long practiced in concealing his troubles, appeared grayer and grimmer today. He was deep in thought and did not notice Robbie at first, even as Favor stared at him. But when he finally glanced up, the fury that shot through his expression exposed him to the core. Anger lay at the heart of Brendan Toohey like fire in a forge. His long face, with its uneven complexion, settled into a harsh smirk, a poor attempt at his customary effort to evince feelings that had no connection to what was actually taking place within. Klecker by now had looked behind and seen Robbie stopped, but hadn't yet realized why. Even circled a finger at her side so that Alf would double back, but he was never going to get close enough. Instead, she crept as near as she dared and took a seat on the fountain's low basin, only a few feet from Robbie. She was fairly certain Toohey wouldn't recognize her. She tried not to stare at either man, affecting the perplexed expression of the average citizen seeking a respite after receiving the usual scuffing from the law. Toohey's words were blown to her in the wind, wavering as it rose and fell.
"Speak of the divil," he said. "Quite a bit of talk about you today, Robbie. Many good folks seem quite vexed. Must say I'm a bit surprised to see you about in these parts."
Favor said he'd had a little unfinished business.
"I'd quite imagine," said Toohey.
From the corner of her eye, Even caught the older man creeping closer.
"It's always been my lot to reassure folks about you. Known Robbie his entire life. Always trusted the boy, no need to doubt him. That's what I've been saying. But now I read the papers, Robbie."
"You can cut the crap, Brendan. My life's over. My prize for flipping on you is a trip to the pokey." Klecker by now had reached the other side of the fountain, but the two men remained far closer to Even. Robbie seemed to be aware where she was and had edged a step or two her way. She remained directly downwind in the cool breeze and still within earshot. Toohey was taking no chances, however.
"Can't imagine a truthful word you'd say about me that would be the least concern. But the penitentiary'll be a good place for you, Robbie. Give you time to contemplate your sins. You've been up to some terrible mischief over these years, if what the papers are saying is true."
"Brendan, you're not impressing me with this routine. I'm not wearing my electronic underwear anymore. Some big boy stole my toy."
With that, Robbie stepped over the side of the fountain and into the low retaining pool. It was only knee-deep, but looking in Toohey's direction, he flopped down for a second into the frothing basin, then spun up like a dog, shaking off water in long, silvery spangles. Favor extended both arms laterally to demonstrate the lack of telltale bulges in his clinging garments. The temperature still hadn't reached much over 50, and Favor eventually drew his arms back, encircling himself in the chill. His designer's sweater now hung to his thighs, and he still hadn't left the pool. Toohey watched him, with his mouth pulled to the side, puzzling it through.
"You're a dramatic fellow, Robbie. I'll give you that. Master of the scene. I remember you 6 years old and singing show tunes like your front stoop was Broadway. Only it wasn't, was it?"
"No, Brendan. I'm not in a Broadway musical. But neither are you. It seems kind of shitty that only one of us is going to the can."
Toohey took his time, assessing this bitter reassurance and the mood in which it had been offered. Robbie was doing a great job of punching his buttons, and in the whirlwind of feelings, Toohey had drifted a few steps but was unable to make himself simply walk away.
"You've always lacked perspective, Robbie. You've had blood in your eye whenever you heard my name since you were 9 years old, lad. You never much cared for the way I'd take your Mame out on that sleeping porch in your apartment and give her a recreational screw on Sunday night. But you know, Robbie, mother or not, the woman had her needs. I've always realized what the burr was under your saddle when it came to me, and been good to you 100 times over ever since. For her sake, not yours. Not that it made an acorn of difference to you.
The rage, so rarely near the surface with him, boiled over again as he pondered Robbie, still up to his knees in the turning water.
Just a mercy fuck now and then for a horny divorcee. And look what it's come to. Can you imagine? And a dead fuck at that.
Having driven the nail in as far as he could, Tui turned in the direction where Even was seated and swept by her and Favor without a glance at either of them. Robbie hopped out of the fountain. He was tightly bound in his arms and bent nearly double in the cold, but he wasn't finished. He called Tui by his first name. The judge paused to deliberate, but remained unable to resist the contest and turned halfway.
"Pity about Rollo," Robbie said.
Across the short distance that separated the two men on the plaza, Even half expected the sizzle of a high-voltage arc. It was Even now. They'd each trampled on the other's grave, but Robbie had one more shot, purely for vengeance. Apparently, he was well past the point of calculation.
"You just remember, Brendan, while you're out in the free air, that the big difference between you and me is that I looked after my best friend."
He'd struck Tui dumb with that. Much as intended. A victor of kinds. Favor sprinted the 20 or so yards to Skulnick's Lincoln in a metered space at the curb. Klecker had not recovered the key from him, and Robbie slid inside. He was not thinking about much, he told me later, besides getting out of the cold and turning on the heater full blast. Even approached Klecker on the other side of the fountain.
"Whoa,"
Alf suddenly said, wheeling. She caught sight of Tui hiking rapidly back toward Robbie and the Lincoln. She began running, but Tui was already motioning for Robbie to roll down the window. If Tui went to the briefcase, she realized she'd have to draw on him. But instead, the judge set the case on the curbside and briefly poked his gray head inside the car. He reached in with one arm. When he turned back to the courthouse, there was a discernible spring in his walk. Whatever Tui had said, it had troubled Favor. He shook his head dumbly when she asked for an account. In the meantime, Amari, in his cowboy boots and his sport coat, had come dashing across the avenue to the car. Joe, who was far more intense than McManus, but generally as contained, was rattling both hands in the air.
"You're the greatest CI I ever worked with," Amari cried.
He grabbed Favor by both shoulders through the lowered window.
"The sharpest! The best! Definitely the best!"
After a moment, she understood. Once Robbie had jumped in the Lincoln and turned the ignition, the camera had revived. Amari had been able to start the taping system, capturing the interlude when Tui leaned into the auto.
"If I saw what I think," said Amari, "you just bagged this guy."
All four of them rushed back down the block to the surveillance van. Alf cued the tape, and the image of Robbie in his wet clothes resolved out of the jumble between scenes. He had one arm around himself as he rocked back and forth on the red leather of Skulnick's auto. He was fiddling with the heater controls when he suddenly started in response to Tui's motions off-screen. Robbie groped for a second before he found the chrome button to lower the automatic window. From the way he drew back, it was clear that Tui had leaned in, but he wasn't fully visible. Only the top of his gray head and his gnarly hand appeared within the frame. Out of the wind, though, his voice was clear as he pointed.
"Speaking of your best pal, Robbie," he said, "when Morton came to warn me on Tuesday about what you were up to, I left him with a message for you. Mind now, Robbie. So many tongues are wagging about you, you might get confused. So I want you to remember, when you get this, that it came from me."
On the screen beside Favor,
Tui rotated the hand with which he'd been pointing. His thumb suddenly came up. With the extended index finger, it had the form of the imaginary pistol little boys forever point at each other. And then, to remove any ambiguity, Brendan, in a bare second, let his long thumb fall like a firing hammer and his hand jump in recoil.
"He's threatening you," said Meeker. "My God, we have him on tape threatening a federal witness."
"I'm telling you," said Amari, "it's a dead bang obstruction." Amari and Klecker cuffed each other, then Alf shook even. Klecker started for Robbie, but Favor had already gotten up to rewind. He wanted to see it again. He replayed the tape, standing right near the screen so he could listen, and then rewound and replayed it once more. By the third time, it was clear which line of Tui's he was re-cueing.
"When Morton came to warn me on Tuesday about what you were up to."
She was baffled herself about what it meant. Alf hailed her up front so they could all call McManus together. Off the skyscraper, through the window, off the scoreboard, nothing but net, said Jim. He permitted himself a single giddy laugh. They had yet to remove the camera from the Lincoln's roof. They drove both vehicles to the federal building where the entire company, save Robbie, left the van and worked with two evidence techs to extract the equipment without any permanent damage to the auto. Then they returned to the Lesueur, where, they'd been told, a substantial audience was already gathering to watch the tape. Robbie was too cold to come along, preferring to get into a change of clothes he kept in the office. For his protection, even accompanied him up. This morning there had been frantic calls from the office about TV crews parked in reception, but building security had routed them by now. Two rent-a-cops were guarding the door. This was the first look any of his employees had gotten of Robbie since the news broke, and he strolled through the over-decorated corridors of his own office to a remarkable silence, deepened both by his bedraggled appearance and by the presence of Even, who seemed to vacillate between friend and foe on an hourly basis. Outside his door, Bonita, looking a bit bleary, shook her dark tresses.
"You don't want none of these messages," she told him.
Even made Robbie promise not to leave the office without calling. Then she returned to McManus's, where they'd held off the viewing until everyone was together. McManus and all the other UCAs, as well as the local agents from the surveillance squad, were elbowed into the conference room. Sennett came huffing in last and delayed 1 second further to call me, but my office reported I was with a client. Alf slid the cassette into the recorder and worked the controls. The screen filled with snow. Alf rewound and fast-forwarded. He fiddled with the connections. Eventually, he realized the tape was blank. He went back to the van to search and returned only with an empty box. It was quite some time before they started looking for Robbie, and that was long after he'd brought the tape they wanted down to me. Robbie had been a sight in my reception area. His clothing was still wet, and for warmth he'd put on a heavy overcoat, a spare he kept in his office. His hair was clinging to his face, looking without its blow-dried buoyancy, like the plumage of a crow that had been jumped by a cat. He asked to see me alone. I was in a meeting, but he promised to be only a minute. In the little reading room beside my office, he handed me the cassette and told me what was on it. Ostensibly, he wanted legal advice about whether he had any grounds to retain the tape. We both knew that was dubious, but Robbie was shopping for time. He had visions of Sennett making a nighttime visit to Mort's home. The tape would be the feature presentation on Mort's big-screen TV, while Stan banged away trying to find out what Tui had meant when he said it was Dinnerstein who'd warned him what Robbie was up to. Robbie wanted to get the answer to that one himself, and, more important, ensure that Mort knew he had no more time before hiring an attorney. Sennett's terror tactics, especially his threats of prison, would turn Morty to pudding. I asked Robbie if he told Mort he was working for the government. I'd long suspected that Robbie had informed Dinnerstein months ago, but Favor insisted he'd kept his partner in the dark, not out of any commitment to Senate, but because he had realized that telling Mort would place Dinnerstein in an impossible position. Sheila Dinnerstein would never have forgiven her son if she knew he'd done nothing when he had a chance to save his Uncle Brendan. Even on Monday, after Evan's melodramatic appearance at the office, when she'd identified herself as FBI Special Agent Dee Dee Kurzweil and served that subpoena, Robbie had told Mort only that he had the situation completely covered.
"He must have scoped it out on his own," Robbie said. "I don't know how, but I figure Brendan was up his alimentary canal with a router the past couple weeks. You know, what's the story with Robbie? Why is he so strange? I still can't believe Morty told him what he figured. I mean, it's Brendan, for God's sake. What did he think his uncle would do, throw me a tea party?"
Robbie was abject, unable even to face me, which was just as well, since I could not think of an appropriate consolation. Blood thicker than water. I realized Robbie had been protecting himself from just this moment when he'd chosen not to tell Mort in the first place. He headed back up to see Dinnerstein, promising to call me as soon as they were done. By 6, I'd heard nothing. I'd had several urgent messages from Stan Sennett by then, which I'd failed to return. I was sure, though, that agents had fanned out seeking Favor, and I expected McManus or Stan at my door any moment. My inside line rang at that point. It was Robbie on his car phone. He'd just been driving around, he said. He told me I should call Mort's lawyer, Sandy Stern. Favor was about to hang up, and I shouted to him to wait. "Had Mort explained?" I asked. "Had he said how he came to tell Tui?"
"Yeah," said Robbie.
For a moment he seemed determined to say no more. Then he gathered himself to the task and added, "He said Stan Sennett asked him to do it." Chapter 43. Although he is only a few years older than I am, Sandy Stern has always been something of my hero. I met him immediately after law school. We were two Eastern graduates practicing as defense lawyers in the inferno of the North End courthouse, and I was instructed by Stern's example. He showed me that no matter what the crime or the client, an advocate could remain an emblem of dignity. He is not much to look at, portly, bald, dark, with a face whose small features are engrossed by too much flesh, but his presence is imposing. He is Argentine by birth, his family the wandering Jews of the saying. A muted Hispanic lilt sings its own rhythm in his careful speech, in which the central cadence is always one of a precisely balanced intelligence. Much like me, he can be remote and chary of feeling. Our friendship has its tidy boundaries that are never crossed. But I came of age here thinking of him as the best lawyer I knew, and for that reason I'd never resented the fact that, in informed minds, he remained, more than me, Kendall County's lawyer of choice in delicate criminal matters. Besides, whatever the wounds to my pride, they were salved by his generous referrals. I was the first outlet for the overflow. Sitting that evening in a corner amid the precise Chippendale surroundings of Stern's club atop the Morgan Towers, he told me a disturbing story. One night last June, Stan Sennett and 3 agents of the Internal Revenue Service had appeared at Mort's home. Sennett claimed to have reliable information, from Moreland's records, as it turned out, that Dinnerstein had a pattern of remarkable success in the Common Law Claims Division, over which his uncle, Brendan Tui, presided. Sennett was going to find out why, one way or the other. Here and now, Mr. Dinnerstein could receive complete immunity and speak with total candor. The alternative was to watch the government wreak havoc in his life, issuing grand jury subpoenas to his bank, his accountant, his clients, his employees, even his neighbors. When Stan found what he expected, Mr. Dinnerstein would be sitting in a federal penitentiary long after both his children had finished college, assuming they'd received scholarships, since Senate would use the racketeering statute to forfeit every penny Mort had made practicing law. Dinnerstein begged time to speak to an attorney, who turned out to be Stern. Fully briefed by his client, Sandy knew two things with reasonable confidence. The first was that Senate had nothing concrete at the moment. Immunity wouldn't have been offered otherwise. The second was that as soon as Stan reached Mort and Robbie's secret checking account at River National, he'd have a good foothold on proving what Mort had acknowledged to Sandy, namely that under his uncle's guidance, Dinnerstein and his partner, Robbie Favor, had been paying off judges of the Common Law Claims Division for years. What Stern offered, therefore, and what Senate ultimately accepted, was that Dinnerstein would become a true confidential informant, and only that. Dinnerstein would fully and truthfully answer any questions Senate asked. None of the information he gave, and nothing that came from it, could ever be used in any way against Dinnerstein, and he would never be called to the witness stand. His identity as an informant would be revealed only if Dinnerstein chose, an unlikely event, given the tumult the news that he'd turned on his uncle would cause in his family. In the best case, if Senate's investigation foundered, Dinnerstein would suffer no disadvantage at all. In the worst, if the full truth about him emerged from other sources, Dinnerstein would resign his law license and attribute escaping prosecution to his attorney's sly manipulations of various legal technicalities, arising from the fact that Mort had never actually had the stomach to deliver any money. "And my client?" I asked. "On his own?" Stern allowed his eyes to slowly close, then open. "Just so," he said. "It was quite painful." Quite, I thought, reflecting almost against my will on the lies Robbie had blithely told to save Mort. The only consolation Stern had offered Mort was that Favor was likely to negotiate an arrangement to guarantee his freedom. Since Robbie alone had had the fortitude to actually make the drops, he was an indispensable witness for Senate. Stern suspected that Favor's deal might include an undercover role, but they knew nothing for certain until mid-April. At that point, Senate had been forced to tell them, because of Dinnerstein's relentless pursuit of the settlement money due poor Peter Petras and his lawyers for Peter's fall from the stadium balcony. To keep Favor in the dark, Mort had agreed to a ruse in which he, like Robbie, immediately recycled his portion of the settlement check, which the government briefly advanced. "Our agreement with the government," said Stern, "is quite clear that Dinnerstein need only answer questions, not volunteer information. But Senate is a treacherous fellow, and I warned my client from the start that sooner or later the U.S. attorney would utilize even the most paltry inaccuracy so he could renegotiate. And naturally that came to pass." Stern eyed me across the top of his drink, scotch neat in a short tumbler etched with the club's crest. "Your client's phantom law license," he said. As I'd surmised last month, Mort had known about that since law school. A few months ago, the IRS agents who'd remained Mort's keepers, much in the way the FBI special agents worked with Favor, had noticed something in the financial information Mort gave the firm's CPA every year. He listed only his own annual dues to bar admissions and discipline as a deductible partnership expense, never Favor's. By then, Morton had referred 100 times to Robbie as an attorney to having practiced law together. Senate regarded this as a cryptical deception rather than a figure of speech. You can imagine the back and forth, but it gave Senate the opening he wanted. On Monday of this week, 3 days ago, he informed me that all could be forgiven if my client agreed to play a speaking part in the elaborate drama in which your client was involved. There was again quite a bit of to-ing and fro-ing, but it was less, frankly, than my worst fears. He simply wanted Morton to tell his uncle that Favor was going to join hands with the government and turn on all of them. I took this as some complicated strategic gambit, part of an endgame. At some point in the future, we'll have a number of brandies, and I'll tell you how it fit in. I was puzzled, and had some dark thoughts, but I have never really followed the tortuous path traveled by Sennett's mind. Several years ago, I was one of the lawyers who assisted Stern when Stan Sennett was threatening to jail him for contempt. Despite my all-night work on a friend of the court brief in support of Sandy, his formal manner prevented me from ever learning, or even asking, precisely how the matter was resolved. Stern was free but somber in the aftermath, and more inclined to speak kindly of vermin than Sennett. I usually tried to avoid any mention of Stan in conversation. A waiter in a green frogged coat approached and fulsomely inquired whether either gentleman wished another cocktail. Another unemployed thespian, he was heavily committed to his role as a servant and actually backed off three steps before turning about. Sennett had wanted recording devices and testimony about Mort's encounter with his uncle, all of which Stern stoutly refused. Dinnerstein had bargained to remain forever in the background. He would be a messenger and no more. Proof was Sennett's concern. But Sennett was resourceful. After years of surveillance, the government knew a great deal about the cast of characters at Paddywhack's. On Monday evening, the Immigration and Naturalization Service paid a visit to one of the busboys who held a counterfeit green card. At 5 o'clock on Tuesday morning, a local IRS agent named Ramos presented himself at the back door of the restaurant to fill in for his cousin, the busboy, who'd purportedly taken ill. An hour later, Mort joined his uncle for breakfast. Mort had been instructed to withhold his revelation about Robbie until the agent playing the busboy was close enough to overhear it. Dinnerstein had barely been able to keep his eyes off the fellow as he circled the tables in his checked pants and white tunic. Finally, when Ramos began swabbing the adjoining foretop, Mort blurted out his news to his uncle and his cronies. Not long after Even had stormed into the office on Monday, announcing she was an FBI agent, Favor's secretary had supposedly approached Dinnerstein, mortified by a phone conversation she'd overheard. Robbie had just called a lawyer and told him to cut a deal with the government, under which Favor would turn and testify against everyone. The judges, Kosick, Toohey, even Mort. It seemed at first that the agent would have no more to report. Toohey said absolutely nothing. Milwaukee uttered a variety of curse words, but Brendan had reached immediately for Sig's hand to still him. Instead, the three men watched as Toohey deliberated. They were drinking coffee out of the heavy, crash-proof crockery at Paddywhack's, and Brendan picked one of the plastic stirrers up off the table and fiddled with it at length, occupying himself. Then Brendan Toohey, presiding judge of the Common Law Claims Division, had held up the brown stirrer by the very end, and Mort had seen what his uncle had fashioned, a noose. Brendan had tied a noose. He twirled it for just a second between his fingers so that Kosick and Milwaukee could view it, and then let it fall to the table. Special Agent Ramos picked it up as he cleared the breakfast dishes, dropping the stirrer in his pocket. A noose? I asked. In the eyes of a prosecutor, or a best friend, Sennett appeared ebullient, but perhaps it was the letter B, or R, for Robbie, or simply a nervous gesture, a matter of opinion, no? And at any rate it might be passed off as table talk, an impulse, without some subsequent act to make the meaning more specific. It's worth very little as evidence, no? Stern swirled down the last of his scotch and held it in his mouth a moment to enrich the descent.
Those are the major details.
My client instructed me to report them for whatever they might be worth. Your discretion, as always, George, is depended upon and appreciated. He took my hand then and squared himself to seek my eyes.
There is deep feeling between these men, he said. Your client has already heard this directly from Dinnerstein, amid a predictable flurry of tears.
And how had Robbie reacted? I preferred not to touch tissue so raw with my client. But these were the imperial moments of the criminal lawyer's life. What did humanity say and do in extremis when a death sentence was pronounced, when a jury set a guilty man free, when a fellow found that the dearest friend of a lifetime had betrayed him? How could the impoverished gestures of daily existence accommodate such a momentous change in understanding? Stern needed no explanation why I wanted to know. Instead, he let his eyes go to the oak beams crossing the ceiling, sharpening his recall of the answer to the question he too had asked.
I am told, he said, that Favor said, what else could you do?
With the kids.
With Joan. What else could you do?
Stern brought his small, alert eyes back to mine.
Interesting fellow, he added.
Chapter 44. So, what else could he do, right? Robbie asked Even. She'd had a moment of terror when it turned out Favor had left the office unaccompanied, but he turned up in the first place she'd looked, here at home. There were two Glen Eyre cops in front, reminding several camera operators from local TV stations exactly where the Fever's property line fell. The officers said they had been running up and down the block for a while, shooting through the windows. There had been a few more who'd left after getting several seconds of Robbie in the Mercedes as he came up the driveway. One jerk rushed in front of the car, and Robbie had rolled him right off the hood. The coppers were still laughing about it. She approached the door in a brusque mood, but Robbie looked like hell, and he told her straight away about Mort. Favor wept, describing how Mort, too, had bawled like a baby as he admitted that he'd given up Robbie to the government to save his own skin. He didn't put a prettier face on it, but he still wanted to be forgiven. And Robbie forgave him. Mort had the kids and Joan. Mort was Mort, and he was Robbie. There was stuff each of them could do, the other couldn't. They'd always known that. And Mort couldn't handle pen time. No way was it possible. So what else could he do? In the paralyzed stillness that followed, she attempted to let her feelings go to him, but they became caught up instead in shock for her own sake. There were a million details to sort through, months of events that she knew intuitively had an entirely different shape than what she thought she'd seen. What the hell had she been doing here? Why an undercover agent in the office if Mort was already reporting to Stan? But that was obvious after a while. She was a beard for Mort, to keep Robbie unsuspecting about who was really informing on him, as happened, for example, with Magda. And without recognizing she was doing it, she in turn was watching Mort for Sennett. All of them secretly spying on somebody, and Sennett the only one to know the truth. He must have felt like God on a bad day, laughing at all his creatures. Embarrassed, Even nevertheless told Robbie at last what she was supposed to. Sennett wanted the tape. Well, I don't have it. Not now. And George told me not to say anything else. She tipped a hand. She wasn't going to quarrel. She called McManus to tell him Favor was okay. Glad there's one of us. McManus had just learned about Mort from Sennett, who had been forced to explain what Toohey meant on the tape. Jim had spent about 10 minutes alone, then raised DC and asked them to start scouting around for a replacement, somebody to run the project as it moved into its next phase. 30 days was the best he could give them. The personalities here, he said, were just too rugged. Jim had already said goodbye to her before he remembered to ask about the videotape. For the moment, he didn't sound as if he cared much more than she did. Thinking about it as she cradled the phone, she realized what must have been getting to McManus. Not just Senate, but UCork. They'd agreed from the start that Jim wouldn't get the skinny about Mort. Some of that was understandable. Agencies rarely shared snitches. The IRS had Mort and kept him to themselves. Need to know, after all. But Jim had been sent out here to do all the heavy lifting, risk the life and limb of his people on the understanding he was in charge. The truth was he was just another marionette, and one who'd worked for months away from home on a case where the IRS, which had developed the critical information, would get most of the credit. She found Robbie in the kitchen, a gigantic space where one side was given over to floor-length sliding windows, another wall to a series of restaurant appliances which Rainey'd had privately enameled in the brightest white known to humanity. Robbie took a half-eaten chicken out of the refrigerator. They sat together at the small breakfast bar and picked at the meat while they each drank a beer. They said very little at first. Then, unexpectedly, he began talking about Mort. "You know, I didn't like Morty at first, when I was a kid." "Really?" She tried to make her curiosity sound more remote than it was, but the pang which remained seemed to constrict the word. "Well, I'm 6 years old. That's when my father ditched us and my ma parked me next door with Sheila Dinnerstein so she could go to work. Now, naturally, I feel like I've been given the greatest screwing since Jehovah called time and adios to everybody from